meeting of the House Oil and Gas Committee and the Senate Resources Committee to consider the TAPS case. Please come to order. Senator Frankamp, Chair of the Board.
Thank you, Rick. The thing I'd like to caution all of those who are speaking with us today to speak very loud. The microphone and recording situation here is not the best in the world. So in anything you have to say to us, would you please speak up? We would like you to keep both your testimony and questions as short as possible, since people have planes to catch, in order to get in what you would like to say. The first ones to testify today to give us an overview will Condon, Attorney General. Will.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Wilson Condon. I'm the State Attorney General. As you know, I'm here to talk about the proposed TAP settlement, and I'm not going to give you a lengthy introduction because of the short time that we have to cover a lot of issues. We've provided a large volume of briefing materials, made other materials available in our office, and your own staffs have generated yet more materials. It seems to us that there are, rather than describing what the settlement is all about, which I'm not going to do, since we've made those materials available and people have been talking about what it does and what it doesn't do, I think we ought to go right to the five issues that ought to be addressed in a discussion of the advisability of entering into this settlement agreement. The five issues, or really six issues, that I have identified that I think that discussion ought to focus on are as follows. First of all, we have what I would call the interior Alaska issues. And presently, the settlement agreement does not address those important in-state issues, particularly the cost of service to Fairbanks. Those issues include two matters of prime importance. One is resolution of rate issues, including the tariff from Prudhoe to Fairbanks, and two, the Quality Bank adjustment. The administration does not plan to go forward with the proposed settlement until these issues are resolved. And I think that we will not have those issues resolved before the legislature adjourns in the next week or 2 weeks or and however, whatever that length of time is. But we will not be signing on the dotted line under any circumstances unless those issues are satisfactorily resolved. Second set of issues are what I would loosely call the Justice Department / Arctic Slope issues, and those have to do with what the tariff level is going to be from 1993 on. And I will, I won't say more about that issue now, but we will be getting into that a little later on. The third issue is simply to discuss what the letter from the lead trial counsel for the FERC staff, Dennis Melvin, means. And this letter was a letter that was addressed to me, and I have not officially received it, but I was able to secure a copy of it from the legislative staff. And that letter has caused considerable concern, some misunderstanding, it needs to be addressed, and the value of that letter and the conclusions that it reaches needs to be addressed. The third issue is whether or not we have a significant likelihood of big refunds. If people believe, after listening to the various analyses, that there is a significant likelihood of big refunds in this litigation, then the settlement doesn't make sense. The fifth point that needs to be discussed is whether or not, out into the future, we can expect extraordinarily lower tariffs than those which would be generated by this settlement agreement. And again, if and the kinds of concerns that need to be discussed there get very technical. If you want to go into them in any depth, it goes into a phrase I hate, rate-making methodology. The way Judge Kane went about figuring out what tariffs ought to be in his decision. But suffice it to say, if people believe that there is a significant likelihood that that something like the Judge Kane methodology is adopted on out into the future, once again, this settlement probably doesn't make a lot of sense. The sixth issue that I think ought to be discussed is the question of the timing of the FERC decision-making process and the ability of the FERC, which is the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, to get this case decided. Now, there has been a questions raised about whether some of this meeting was going to be conducted in executive session. And I'd like to make just a couple of comments on that. It seems to me that in terms of things that we might say, there are probably three or four short comments that might be made by Mr. Robert Loeffler, sitting to my left, in the testimony that he will give, which he probably would not give unless he is able to give that in executive session. The vast bulk of his testimony he would like to give in an executive session, and given the fact that this is a matter of extremely important public policy concern in this state, I think it ought to be given in open session. And so, with respect to things that we have to say, I would imagine they probably can be covered in something greater than 5 but less than 10 minutes at the end of Mr. Loeffler's testimony, if the committee wants to do it that way. Otherwise, we can certainly forego it. Appearing with me today for the executive branch on this matter are Robert Loeffler from the law firm of Morrison & Forster in Washington, D.C., his colleague from the same firm, Henry Levine, and Robert Stoller, who is presently a private attorney in Wichita, Kansas, but who was formerly an assistant attorney general with our department and was the staff counsel for the APUC, has been working on this project since the mid-autumn as the person responsible for getting the logistics accomplished of getting people together to get decisions made, to get briefing materials put together so that people responsible for both making decisions and conducting negotiations could carry them out. And those are the people who are here with me today. My understanding is that you intended to take testimony from some other people before Bob Loeffler comes back to testify. That's the conclusion of my introductory comments. And I guess I'd make one other. People are no doubt going to have questions that they would like to ask of me, but I guess I would ask that those questions be deferred until after you have a chance to hear from Messrs. Loeffler and Levine, since they must leave at 5:30 to catch the 6 o'clock play.
Mr. Condon, I would be very happy for them to go ahead at this time with any testimony that is open to the public and just to have that now. The only reason for them being listed at the bottom was during the executive session. So go right ahead.
Thank you, Senator Farrakhan. Let me start out by giving you an idea of my qualifications, and then I will go directly to the issues in general terms that I'm supposed to address. I am a partner in a 185-lawyer law firm. I've been managing partner of the Washington office. I'm currently head of the litigation department of that office. I will resume the position of managing partner next January. I've handled every sort of case before the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and its predecessor, the Federal Power Commission, meaning I've handled wholesale electric cases for electric utilities. I've handled alternate energy cases and gas pipeline cases, gas curtailment cases. I've handled all the gas matters for the state with respect to both the PAC-Alaska and the Alaska Highway Gas Project. I've known the last three chairmen of the commission personally. I'm also the chief litigation counsel for the Northern Tier Oil Pipeline with regard to its federal litigation. I have a fair background in utility practice. With any sort of settlement, you're talking about matters of judgment. And if things were black and white, there would be no need to go ahead because everyone would agree on what the result is going to be. A number of the judgments that went into the settlement were mine, and we'll get into those in some degree of detail here. Let me talk about what the FERC staff is. I think you're all aware of the letter from Dennis Melvin, who is the trial counsel. The FERC is an odd body. It has various staffs. The trial staff, of which Mr. Melvin is a member, is created to be an advocate of the consumer interest or the ratepayer interest. It's sort of an in-house public defender's office. They are not the decision-making staff who advise the commissioners on what decision should be made, and there is a distinct separation of functions. They are an advocate. They are like the state of Alaska. They have been our ally in asserting the positions up to now in the litigation. But it's important to bear in mind that the trial staff does not represent the views of the commission. The views of the commission are decided in the first instance by the law judge who sits on the case, and then on appeal by the commissioners, and then by the Court of Appeals, and perhaps by Congress. The nature of the positions asserted by the FERC staff is they defend the consumer or ratepayer interest. They often take extreme positions. That's their job. I'll give you several examples. In the Trailblazer case, which just came out, the FERC staff asserted that the right rate of return on equity was 11%. The FERC gave 17% and said 20 would be allowable if the applicant had requested. In the incentive rate of return on the Alaska Gas Pipeline, FERC staff urged around 11%. Commission came out with 14%. In an issue of concern to Alaskans, the impact of the Alaska Gas Pipeline on highways in Alaska and on causing socioeconomic impact, the FERC staff has urged the trial staff again that the state of Alaska is going to receive billions of dollars in benefits from the project, and not one cent should be paid to the state of Alaska for highway repair until those billions of dollars of benefits are exhausted. I think you need to know those remarks to put in context what Mr. Melvin has said in his letter. One other point on the FERC staff. We have met with them over time on the settlement. In fact, 2 weeks ago, both Mr. Levine and Mr. Toomey, one of our trial counsel firms on this case, talked about the settlement with Mr. Melvin, and he said, well, I don't like it very much, but it's certain that the FERC, the commissioners themselves, are going to approve this. Now, let's take the substance of his letter.
Madam Chairman.
Yes.
Madam Chairman, could you ask that last statement to repeat, please?
Sure. Would you like me to repeat? Hank, you were there, so why don't you repeat it?
I can add to it a little bit. At least in several conversations over the last 4 or 5 weeks, and specifically at the meeting, at a meeting held in our offices at which Ed Toomey, another trial lawyer of the representing the state in this matter, were present. The FERC staff, including the FERC trial staff, including Mr. Melvin, Mr. Melvin's boss, and the gentleman who does their number work, their number cruncher, reiterated or stated several times quite clearly that there were certain aspects of the settlement with which they were not happy, but that they believed that no matter what position they took, the commission, when it considered the settlement, would conclude that it was just and reasonable and in the public interest and would approve it.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Would you proceed?
Let's go to the merits of the letter of the FERC staff. The letter assumes one view of the regulatory world. It's the view that's been used for gas pipelines and electric utilities, but has not been used for oil pipelines. That's the great controversy in the Taft case, and that's the great controversy in the Williams case, which is for the whole oil pipeline industry. The view of the world it assumes is the so-called appreciated original cost view. And even that view is slightly clouded because they, in several respects, use numbers we don't understand or out-of-date numbers. I don't want to get into great detail, but there are increasing signs coming out of the commissioners themselves that they will not extend that form of rate-making methodology to oil pipelines. And that, and those reasons I'll get into later. Unlike judges, the FERC commissioners go around the country and give speeches in which they announce their view of what the world should be in a regulatory sense. And we in the industry, in a sense, follow those speeches with bated breath because we want to know what they're going to do and we want to pitch our arguments to what they say in their speeches. We have other indications, which I can't get into now, that for oil pipelines, they're looking at rate-making methodologies which are far more favorable to the oil pipelines than the depreciated original cost methodology that Mr. Melvin's letter says is the only one that he can see applying. Even if you applied the depreciated original cost methodology, but updated it from the time of the judge's first decision to the interest rates which are current today, and made certain favorable tax assumptions, the settlement would be justified on current terms. You don't even have to go to the methodologies which there are a substantial chance of being applied to accept. I want to keep it at that level of generality for now. On the question of refunds, the refunds that have been quoted in some memos are about as reliable as last year's projection of next year's oil revenues, in several respects. They assume one view of the world on a case which has not been decided on appeal and to the commission, let alone to the courts. As I've said, the signs are leading towards higher, not lower tariffs. The question of when you would get those dollars is very important, because as you all know, dollars 10 years from now don't mean anything, or mean very little compared to dollars now. Before I was a partner in my present firm, I was a partner in a public utility firm. The head of the public utility section of that firm was 52. He said FERC had never decided a wholesale rate case in his 26 years of practice before that. The case kept going back and forth between the courts and the commission. The commissioners changed, the staff changed. The realistic possibility of getting solid dollars soon from the commission because of a decision by them upheld by the court is not very great. The commission's got the worst record in Washington before the Court of Appeals. From the decisions I've seen, they're reversed at least half the time. There is another angle to the timing, which I don't want to get into, but there are ways the commission can handle this case that could lead to the dismissal of the whole case with nothing to the state. What's before the commission now is the rates in the early years. The commission, without really mucking around, could find ways of finding those rates just and reasonable. One way of doing that would simply be to say the state has not made its case. It's not met the burden of proof, which is on the state, to prove those initial rates were not just and reasonable. Even if the state won its case in the early years, forgetting about court appeals, the owners of the pipeline can do what we call in the trade pancake. They can file a rate case every year, keep going through, say each year is a little different, go through the process, drag people out. I mean, it's one of the objectionable parts of the regulatory process that it exists, the panic. There are something like 2,000 or 3,000 electric rate cases stacked up at the commission.
is you file each case based on a test year, and you have each test year as you go into the future. There are all sorts of procedural and other ways of just stringing this case on forever. In looking at whether to go with the settlement, we made judgments of the probabilities of these different alternatives, judgments as to what we might get now, what we might get 5 or 10 or 15 years from now, what would happen if Congress deregulated the industry. We reached what we thought was an informed judgment that, considering the alternatives, the settlement made good sense now. I will go into those judgments more later, but it's like any other case. You deserve to know the basis for our judgment. We'll try and give you as much as we can. You can't be certain that it's right. The easiest thing to do is to continue on litigation until you get a conclusion someday. But I can't tell you when that will be or what the result will be, and I don't think anyone else can.
Is there further overview or testimony from...
Would you want to add anything to that, Hank?
The only thing I would want to add, which is implicit in what Mr. LaFleur said, is that the FERC trial staff in particular, and this is implicit in what Mr. Melvin told me at the meetings, but you should know it specifically, does not carry, particularly in the oil pipeline area, but in many other areas, a great deal of weight with the commission. That's the only thing that I would add to your remarks.
Are there questions from Rick?
It just seems that maybe what you're saying is that in evaluating cost-benefit settlement, on the benefit side, we probably won't see any benefits for somewhere in excess of 10 years if we don't settle this case.
Well, the common parlance used is 10 years. It could be longer than that. It might be shorter. But I think that's a realistic...
So we may be 10 years and $20 or $30 million in legal fees away from another or a complete case.
There are cases that never get decided because you have to do it perfectly, and the bigger the, not perfectly, you have to do it substantially right, but the bigger the consequences, the closer the court looks at it, and the more likely they're to say, send it back, you didn't do this right, in the hope that the party settle. Frankly, the commission doesn't want the case. I can tell you from cocktail party chatter, they just as soon have the party settle. The Department of Justice, we were in there this week talking to the Assistant Attorney General in charge of the antitrust division. He said, maybe we should find a way to take the case away from the commission because they won't decide. 10 years is a reasonable guess, but there's a possibility, it's a minority chance, that they'll just never get a final resolution.
Senator Fisher?
Madam Chair, could you tell me what the best possible case could be, best possible settlement for the state? You say that, so I think you said that the worst that could happen in a way would be the commission would just dismiss the case. And
that's
then,
right.
And then we get nothing. We're stuck with the high tariff and the fees that have been paid so far.
The best possible result would be an adoption of the judge's decision, Judge Kane's decision. There's best and there's most likely best case, if you get the difference. With Judge Kane's decision, of course, he had an automatic adjustment formula in there to reflect current interest rates. You'd get a much higher tariff just adjusting upwards to reflect today's interest rate environment. Winning, I guess, most of the other issues before. And that would come out with tariffs. Well, we did an analysis of this, and it would come out with tariffs, what would you say, slightly below or approximating the settlement tariff about this time, but with the tariff curve sloping downwards into the future. When you talk about sloping downwards into the future, you've got to remember the ability of the owners to come through with increase, rate increase application.
What about refunds? What kind of dollar refund might be expected under that kind of, let's say, Judge Kane's decision?
If you're talking about the present value of refunds and reduced tariffs between this proposed settlement and a straight Judge Kane decision, I think Bill Barker can give you that number both in present day dollars and discounted dollars. And what was the number you were using? 3.1 nominal dollars, 1.7.
That was the difference between Yes, the difference between the Kane tariffs and the settlement tariffs would have been about $3.1 billion in nominal dollars, about $1.7 billion in cost of $1982.
But that does not reflect adjustment of Kane for current interest rates, so it would be somewhat below.
That's not adjusting Kane?
That's unadjusted.
That's straight Kane 11.5%.
Representative Gott.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Leffler, you mentioned that a number of the judgments that went into the settlement were yours. And I assume also that you received direction from the Hammond administration expressing what their desires were. And I suggest that, and maybe you should correct me if I'm wrong, but I suggest that, that the governor would like to have this case settled while he's still in office. I suggest that the governor is interested to a great extent certainty as far as predicting revenues, and I just wonder how heavy those types of judgments on the part of the administration, how heavy they influenced you, and what other direction from the administration may have affected your judgments that might otherwise have resulted in perhaps a different judgment on your part.
Well, we tried to approach the settlement from a team basis. I think a question has been raised about the other two law firms that have been litigating the case. We had all too many meetings of six or more attorneys, including those other two law firms, from the beginning of the settlement process, so everyone had an input. The negotiations were in two parts. I would say, in fairness, well, that the principal outlines of the settlement were negotiated by you and Bob Stoller, and we filled in. But we contributed to your position on the principal outlines. The quest for certainty with respect to the TAPS tariff was a very strong consideration. The desire to settle the case within the Hammond administration, tenure in office, I heard from the first time today.
What do you mean, from me?
Yeah. The desire was simply in terms of all the state's royalty oil contracts, in terms of the state's income tax laws, in terms of a lot of other things, it made sense to get a settlement tariff for a definite period of time. But I never heard it linked to tenure of the administration.
Representative
Vasco. I think we'll want to respond.
Can I just make a couple of comments on that? The discussion has evolved in a little bit different way than I thought it might. If I had just thought I was going to come in and put on a dog and pony show, I would have started off by explaining a little bit about why did we start off with settlement negotiations. But I thought we would be so limited in time that I couldn't do that, but it's probably appropriate to do that now. Last year, when we were trying to secure an appropriation and get the money so that we didn't just have to shut down the litigation in March a year ago, we had to spend a lot of time discussing with members of the House who were then in the minority what we had to do to get an effective date on the bill so that we could keep the litigation going. And one of the expressions that we heard a number of times from those people, as well as from a number of other people who were not in the then House minority, was that, listen, you ought to make some serious efforts to try and settle this litigation, and if you do, you promise you'll do that, you'll get your money. And so after the legislature adjourned last year and we had our appropriation to continue on with the litigation, what do we do? Do we simply throw out an offer that we know the companies will not accept, come back and say, look, we made a settlement offer and they didn't accept it, now let's go on with the litigation, or should we make an honest attempt to really evaluate this case? Frankly, I've been through one very controversial settlement of litigation with the oil companies, one modestly controversial settlement of litigation. I was involved in the debate over the corporate income tax discussion last year, and it's an awful lot easier just to get the money and spend it and let this litigation roll on, as far as I'm concerned personally. So I was not particularly anxious to jump into another one of these, but after discussing this at some length with Bob Maynard of my staff about what was the responsible thing to do in this particular instance, and as most of you know, he's a person who handles a lot of oil and gas litigation stuff in our office, it was his recommendation to me that we try and find somebody to work full-time on the case to do the kind of background staff work that's required, because even though I think I know a fair amount about both utility rate making and the oil and gas in general, I just don't have the time to spend 60 hours a week on an effort like this, as you should, in terms of getting the staff work done, in terms of coordinating the efforts of three separate outside law firms, in terms of getting numbers crunched by independent consultants, in terms of trying to go to other outside consultants to get a reality check to see whether the numbers we came up with made any sense. And further, Bob Maynard recommended that I try and get Bob Stoller, who used to be an assistant AG in our office, to come back and work for us and do that kind of staff work. And so I did that. And then we started off. We met with all of our trial counsel in Washington, D.C. We met with the Justice Department's their economic advisors, and all of our trial counsel in New York. We had meeting up here and a meeting in San Francisco. And in each one of those, we went through and tried to get the collective judgments of all the attorneys involved on what we thought were the critical issues. What were we going to have in the way of a methodology and hence a tariff on out into the future, and what were our what was the likelihood of a refund? Out of that, we prepared what we called a white paper and presented to the governor. Said, Governor, do you think it makes any sense to go ahead and move ahead with settlement negotiations based on this analysis and on these concerns? And he said, yes, it did. And then from that stage on, with respect to each offer we made in terms of negotiating the conceptual basis of this settlement, we had a meeting with all of our attorneys, sat down, argued out about what our next offer or counteroffer was going to be, and then Bob Stoller and I met individually with the company we were negotiating with, which was British Petroleum. And then when we received a counteroffer from them, we in turn had another meeting, reviewed where we were, and then the two of us met with their representatives. And that's the way the process evolved. When we had an understanding in principle, then the firm of Morrison & Foerster took over the day-to-day negotiation of working out the details, which was a full-time job for more than one attorney there, and it didn't make sense for me to be involved in that, and there were just a lot of other side issues that took all of Bob Stoller's time in terms of trying to move this process along. And that's how it happened. Now, in terms of trying to involve other people who had an interest in this, we were very concerned about where the Justice Department and the FERC staff were going to come out in this. And so when we finished a draft of the white paper in November, which was governor, the question at the end of the white paper is, Governor, should we move ahead with settlement negotiations? We went to the Justice Department, and we sat down with the Justice Department, showed them a draft of the white paper, and said, this is the decision document we're going to present to the governor. And would you please make a recommendation or change your guesses about any of our probabilities? And they made their recommendations. Similarly, we sat down with the FERC staff, and I guess that's the one thing about Dennis Melvin's letter that I really quarrel with, about not being involved. I mean, they've been involved in the internal decision-making process of the state. They were not involved in the meetings about should we offer them 411 next time, but they were involved in preparing the background briefing. And so that is a perhaps too long explanation of how this process evolved, but it had nothing to do with we want to get it done by the time I leave office.
Let me just follow up just real quickly here, then I'll yield, Madam Chairman. I appreciate it. So you're saying that that you didn't give serious consideration to settlement until the Republicans blackmailed you into not giving you an effective date vote?
Well, and there are all kinds of ways you can make that statement.
I mean, it sounds like that's what you said.
That was the main impetus to starting to spend a lot of time thinking about whether settlement made sense.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Representative Baskin.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I had a question for Mr. Loughran. Mr. Halpert asked you the settlement time frame or the litigation time frame. You said 10 years. Is that 10 years from 5 years ago or is that 10 years from now?
I may be going out on a limb, but I think it's 10 years from now.
So it would be a total of 15 years for the litigation to settle, if in fact it does, because you did say that some cases never settled at all.
Well, the companion Williams case has been going on now, I don't know, it's 10 or 12 years.
10 and a half years.
3 years ago, before that it would decide the case expeditiously, it hasn't issued an opinion yet.
Well, in your opinion, the time frame for the settlement would potentially have some benefit for the state of Alaska. The benefit accrued to the pipeline owners or the producers would be very different depending on the case. Do you have a recommendation to this body for that?
I'm not sure I understand your question. Why don't you give me a little more?
The time frame that you're giving us is 15 years for the settlement of the litigation. If you agree to a settlement, the benefits accrued to both the state and to the pipeline owners or the pipelines would be very different.
Right.
Presumably you're going to break that down for us.
You want us to look at what the benefits are from the pipeline's point of view as well as the state's.
It would be a follow-up question to...
I think we could prepare some material. I'll give you a brief answer now, if you like. I don't represent them, so I don't pretend to know what they think, but it is ending a major dispute with the state. It's ending a costly litigation. It gives them some certainty. The joke in the trade removes a footnote from their annual reports in terms of the potential refund liability, uncertainty of rates. It gives them 10 years of certainty also, removes the controversy, the cost of the controversy. I don't know how they book their refund liability, but there's been some suggestion that the added certainty would drive them into a firm position supporting the gas company. I couldn't speak to them on that. The certainty factor and the end of litigation, I think, applies to both sides.
A follow-up question, Madam Chair. In terms of litigation from the producers or the pipelines, if in fact the state did settle this case, would that in fact stop, not for all practical purposes or for all time, would that stop litigation by the pipelines or the producers on the state for the kinds of policies it needs to take in the future?
For example, the corporate income tax case or, mm-hmm. or I don't know what other big issues there are.
Or the rate-making policy if it's going to be established.
It will stop the controversy on rate-making policy for 10 years. If it's the end of 10 years, all bets are off. It's a 10-year settlement. There are several possibilities at the end of 10 years. One is it's extended. Second is that Congress goes ahead and deregulates oil pipelines, including caps. And it's, whatever you want to call it, a free market situation. A third possibility at the end of 10 years, that they may have finished the Williams case 20 and a half years after it started, and the methodology will be settled, but it's someone else's cost. It only buys you about 10 years of service.
Mr. Leffler, you mentioned the legal code. How do you see that as affecting the tariff?
Let me address two parts of that. One is the so-called consent decree, which there's a 1941 consent decree between the Department of Justice and the owners of oil pipelines at that time, which limits effectively, I'm not going to get into the technical, the level of pipeline rates. Our ally, the Department of Justice, last fall moved to vacate the consent decree, which would limit the only effective ceiling. Remove the only effective ceiling on oil pipeline rates. We tried to get into the case. The Department of Justice opposed us, but we got in anyway. And we said, you can't remove this limit until there's something that replaces it. And now that's in settlement negotiations. But, so that, if FERC has not acted and the consent decree is vacated, all bets are off. Rates could go anywhere. The owners want them to. At the moment, they're happy to fashion their rates as publicly admitted around consent decree limits. With deregulation, the question is whether you include caps. Caps is included. It's whatever makes economic sense to the company. And, I think there would be an incentive for them, as much as possible, to shift dollars into the transportation lane away from the producing lane. So I would not expect to see rates go down. I would expect to see them go up. There's total deregulation.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Mr. Leffler and the Attorney General both said that the easy thing to do is to keep going ahead. And yet the picture they paint is, why go ahead and waste our money, in effect? Now, is that because they don't think we've got any chance of winning, or simply because of the time factor? So we're too small, too big to fight against the big boys, you know, like BP? Or what is the crux of
the we looked at various outcomes, and some of them are favorable to us.
Excuse me, is that not the kind of question?
I really would rather go into that in executive session. I think I could give you a little more detail. You obviously are making a predictive judgment as to what the agency will do. You look at the personalities, the backgrounds of the commissioners who are in office today, the trends in regulatory policy. Today, the FERC is awarding rates of return. In the last week, I've seen 17, 18, 19%. 3-4 years ago, you never heard anything about 15, and that was only for utility and severe economic distress. You look at a lot of things, and you make your best informed judgment as to what's happening. Now, we did that, and I'll give you, I think, later, a sense of where we think things are coming out. And what we think about the strength of various parts of our case.
Yeah. Okay. Mr. Fisher, and then I'd please like the whole question so we can hear from people who have plain sketch.
Okay, I'm one of those. My understanding is that the settlement tariff would be $4.625, is that correct?
$4.625 is the starting point in
1980. Right, with an average and constant dollar of $3.802.
The average discounted.
Now, according to Melvin's letter, the FERC counsel, applying that to the original tariff, the state could be due, or the public could be due at death, or somebody, $3.2 billion in refunds. Is that a correct figure this is on page 7 in the third paragraph.
The other thing was that assuming that the methodology that came were affirmed,
assuming, right.
Then the difference between Kane affirmed on its face, exactly what Judge Kane ordered, and what the companies have charged to date, not the settlement tariff, what the companies have charged to date, then the shippers or whoever, most of whom are also the pipeline, are also the pipeline owners, so it's mostly money going from one pocket to another, would be due a very substantial amount, and they're not due rent would be the correct.
$800 million.
The state's interest is roughly 24%.
So the state would get $800 million if there were a refund?
If you make all the assumptions we listed, it's sustained by the Court of Appeals, the state would then get the refund with interest. The rate, in effect, that's the rate we're arguing for, 6.25%. So you might, let's be optimistic, it's 1987, so you get your money at 6.25%.
One more question, still trying to understand this particular paper. Melvin makes a statement that the settlement rate of return on equity would give ARCO 40.72%, Exxon 42.65%, and you were talking about going as high as 18%. So,
let me a couple of things. First, in terms of overall rates of return, the numbers are considerably lower, and indeed not far from what FERC is currently issuing. FERC, at least the ALJ and had a set of analysts. They came up with very different numbers, and we had a series of meetings to basically pound out in what amounted to an adversary setting what the real numbers sort of were. A lot of it depends on the methodology you adopt, the rate of return you adopt. But I think it's fair to say that based on a reasonable economic analysis, the real rates of return after taxes from the settlement are consistent with an 8% real rate of return on total investment after taxes. Now it depends on the methodology. Using the methodology Mr. Melvin adopts, you get higher numbers. But including an allowance for the refund, we got the refund closer to 5.5%. Including an allowance for refund, we believe that the settlement tariffs, the Justice Department's numbers confirmed it, both sets of consultants, that the settlement tariffs are consistent with real rates of return after taxes on the order of 8%. I think the actual number is 7.8, but I'll allow 0.2 as a punch back.
But we're not providing for refunds.
That number treats refunds as accelerated depreciation, in effect. It makes the companies take the refund. They don't pay out money, but they reduce their rate base by the amount they would otherwise have had to refund. Which is consistent with utility theory to the extent that frequently a depreciation is considered a removal from rate base that is received. So one way of treating a huge refund liability is to say it should be taken as if it was a huge jump of depreciation taken all at once.
I'd like to go back to the timing. When do you have to leave?
Well, I'm on that 6 o'clock flight. I'm very sorry. Dinner I can host you, and I've got it set up for 2.5 months tomorrow night. The only way to get back to Washington is if I leave you at the time. So I have more things I could say, I think.
Madam Chairman, we certainly intended to try and go through absolutely as much as we could and then possibly go into executive session, but because of your time schedule, because I think you are the people who want to ask some very specific questions that fit directly into 4462.310 under the open meetings law. At this time, I would move that we go into executive session. The nature of the testimony is clearly exactly what's dealt with in the open meetings law. It directly affects the finances of the state. Executive session is open to all members of the legislature. The meeting would be recorded, and if there were any things that were not necessary to be an executive session, that portion of any recorded transcript, I'm sure, will be available to the public and the press. So at this time, I'll make that motion.
Mr.
Madam Chairman, I would object that I don't think that it's absolutely necessary that in the next hour we need to settle this matter. I think that the public needs to give comment and hear comment from the people who purport to represent the state in this issue, and that we probably need months on this, because hearing from the public and hearing from those interested private parties on the settlement, and if they have to go back to Washington, they should, but they should come back and explain to the Alaska public and to the state legislature, at least the Resources Committee, and to the administration, the exact position of this case. The case is large enough so that we don't, in 55 minutes, cannot figure it out.
Madam Chair, I personally don't object to the executive session, but picking up from Mr. Vasquez's comment, I'm wondering about the timeliness. The governor, in his letter to Senate President Krutula of April 16 regarding the settlement, stated, "It is my intent to accept the settlement unless the legislature by concurrent resolution expressly advises against doing so." Now, Madam Chair, the legislature may have a week, maybe a little more than a week, to do so. And if I may, I'd like to ask the Attorney General if it would be possible and appropriate to see whether the governor will postpone his decision on the settlement, maybe giving the legislature 2-3 months for a thorough investigation of this issue to determine a position. I think that would meet Mr. Vasquez's problem too.
It wasn't my intent that we go into executive session and make any decision. The public meeting law specifically provides that you cannot take any action in executive session. It was only my intent that while we have these people here, whatever information we can gather in executive session that is inappropriate in an open session, we go ahead and deal with that information. But I certainly wouldn't advocate a decision based on an executive session, and I don't think that's what the public meeting law intends or what I meant by the motion.
I wouldn't entertain a motion on that. I understand. Yes.
I'm going to be very brief because we're going to use up all our time deciding whether they're going to be meeting or not. I do think it's important that we get this information. I think if the only way to get it is an executive session, we ought to do that. I agree totally with the comments you made that this is far too significant an issue to make a decision rapidly on, and I would hope that there is a time frame somehow allowed that we have the time for legislature to make a considered judgment on the matter. With that, I would strongly support going into executive session at this moment.
What is the pleasure of the committee? Motion has been made.
Ask unanimous consent.
Ask unanimous consent? Is there objection further? Then the committee will go into executive session at this time. I'd ask that
the chairman. Yes. On behalf of the principal, I've been asked to project the executive session and ask you specifically what questions you'll be asked in the executive session.
We will only ask questions and discuss things that could not be discussed in public in a court case. That would be a way. We'll come back in the general session for the rest of the testimony. Would those people who are not legislators please vacate the room? We're going to be as brief as possible and come right back in the general session.
Madam Chair.
I'll take some action before I leave here in a second. Go ahead and accept the settlement. Can you give us any respect at this time as to how firm that is, what latitude it is, and if not?
Well, I haven't talked to him about it directly, so I don't know. I am sure that it's going to take us some time to work out the arrangements with relating to the tariff in Fairbanks. And the question is related to the Quality Bank in any event, so there is going to be some time. How all of that would work involving the legislature in the decision-making process after the legislature adjourns, I don't know, but they can address it together. We have gotten kind of crosswise on time here. We started in September. We wanted to try and get something put together early in the legislative session because the governor insisted on having it available for the legislature to review, and we didn't get it until mid-April. So that's not a very good answer.
It's there'd be no way for Westbrook to be involved short of a special session. If we didn't take some question of what they wanted and what some arrangement was made to use an interim committee as a vehicle for doing that.
That was in the ballot.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Kind of follow up on the same thing. If we don't take action this year, and if the settlement is not agreed to, what position are we in next year? If we were to put off the decision until the next session, what would the effect on where we've gotten so far in negotiating the parties be? Do you think we lose ground? Is this something that's a window that we're looking at going by?
There are a lot of different ways it could play out. I mean, let's suppose that the legislature doesn't take action, but we cannot reach it. We cannot resolve the governor still comfortable with going ahead. No, the legislature takes no action. They decline the offer of disapproval. So there's no disapproval, but the governor feels comfortable with it. Perhaps if we can work out the loose ends that I've outlined here, then I assume we just go ahead with it. On the other hand, we don't go ahead with the settlement, obviously we're going to be in a situation where a new governor and a new attorney general are just going to have to deal with the problem.
So what do we lose by that in terms of the settlement? Are we at risk of losing the gains in the existing settlement?
Well,
by not ratifying it.
I haven't thought that through carefully, so I'm speculating as I talk here about what would happen. What we have is a situation where the tariffs probably would stay where they are. The Justice Department has moved to dissolve the consent decree, and that's why the tariff did not come down. Everybody come down as Exxon did. The Justice Department in the settlement negotiations with the companies is talking about giving all of that money back to the carriers as long as they reinvest it in their company. And so the net effect of all of that in the short range would be to have a big hunk of money that might have come to us as a result of reduced tariffs go directly back to the companies as a result of the settlement of the consent decree. And then I don't know where tariffs, I suppose tariffs will stay. Once the consent decree guillotine comes down and they close out all of those accounts, then I just think the tariffs will stay up until there's some resolution by settlement or litigation with the FERC. But it's a short-term one.
Okay, yeah, there's a two-part question. Do we lose the deal basically with one of them, and the other one, I guess your answer is, well, at least we lose the increase in revenue for whatever time we have a major federal
right.
We probably won't pick that up in the future.
We certainly won't pick up some of it, because it's almost a certainty, in my view, that the settlement of the consent decree litigation put that money right back into the pipeline company.
So, no, I think it might mean a couple hundred million dollars.
It could be. That's right.
Better than it got.
Will you finish it?
Yeah.
Is there a solid offer right now that the legislature can say yes or no to, or what are these loose ends you're referring to? Are there still things that aren't solid as far as a negotiated settlement that you want to talk about?
Yeah, there are three things that are loose ends which we still like to tie down. Two of them we're absolutely committed to tie down, and those are the question of rates to Fairbanks and the Quality Bank issue on the pipeline. Those are not going to be settled unless the only way they can be settled is if they're satisfactory to the real parties in interest, which are the Golden Valley Electric Utility and the existing and potential refinery in Fairbanks.
Could you remind me what a Quality Bank adjustment is?
I'll let the people from whoever have a direct interest in that
explain it.
All right, we can get to that later. There's a third thing you want to cover.
And the third thing is, we do not want to go before the FERC and ask for FERC approval without at least the non-opposition of the Justice Department, if at all possible. So we would like to be able to get something which takes care of the minimal concerns of the Justice Department from 1993 on. We have not, if the Justice Department and the companies absolutely cannot agree, then we have to decide whether we are willing to go into the, whether we want to go ahead with the settlement and ask for FERC approval in spite of Justice Department opposition. And that's a loose end we would like to tie down, but we're not absolutely committed to doing it.
Are there any other terms that you might not want to discuss?
No.
That you and I have already discussed?
I don't think so.
Like the ad valorem adjustment?
Well,
that's still a consideration.
We can go through the... Actually, we should have had Hank go through all of those.
I mean, I understood that wasn't in concurrence now between British Petroleum and the State of Alaska.
I think it is.
Oh, it is
I
now?
I think it is.
Under the original condition?
Yes.
All right. Thank you.
I have another question. Further comment for me before we call them?
Madam Chair, I've been reminded what a quality bank adjustment was, so I don't really need a refresher course on that unless you wanted to do it for some other reason.
Ben, thank you very much. Excuse me, I didn't see your hand.
In the information that was submitted to the legislature on the proposed settlement of the TAP tariff, states that the initial 1982 tariff would be 4.65 cents per barrel. And in the information that was also submitted with that, a letter from the Governor General 28, 1982, says you're further authorized to represent my willingness to recommend the legislature settlement as high as $4.45 per barrel for 1982, 40% of which would escalate the rate of inflation. The difference between $4.45 and $4.625 on state royalty oil alone is over $100 million a unit tariff rate. Is there a later letter from the governor on this?
No, there is not a later letter that letter, along with the previous letter, simply spells out what the specific dollar we were authorized to offer in each stage of the negotiation. And when we came back as a result of the exchanges after January 28th, so they're not reflected in the correspondence back and forth between our office and the government.
I
agree.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, I had one other question. And remind me here if we should be talking about this, Mr. Condon. The whole question of deregulation of pipelines, I think that maybe Representative Malone would have rather asked the question, because I think he had some recent discussions with some of our congressional delegation in Washington, D.C., and it's my understanding that there's a very little likelihood that pipelines will be deregulated, or at least that the TAP line would ever be deregulated. I just wondered, would you say that possibility was a significant, or it played any part in, did it influence your decision on any of these settlement judgments?
Yes, it did. Some of our outside counsel believe that settling this case significantly raised the possibility of deregulation. In other words, if we settle, that takes the heat off the FERC and the Congress. If they got a settlement in place, they can just go ahead and deregulate it, continue to ride the flight charger of deregulation, realizing that there won't be adverse consequences in Alaska if that happens. And I still think that that's a remote possibility, so we did not factor that in. Although we thought a lot about it, and for somebody it is a the possibility of deregulation gives you a reason to oppose the settlement. If you think there is a significant possibility that this will increase the chances of deregulation, then we'll, there won't be anything in place in 1993 at all to regulate tariffs. And we are concerned about deregulation. We are going to participate in preparing testimony and studies to support the need oil pipeline regulation.
You're saying that if a person thinks that the TAP line won't be deregulated, say I think that, and then would that lean me more in favor of a settlement or away from a settlement?
If you think the pipeline will not be regulated, that should lean you more in favor of a settlement. The way
will not be regulated. Okay, I don't think it's going to be deregulated.
Well, that should make you like the settlement better because you know, there isn't any risk that you're taking the heat off Congress. And that's spelled out in our little pros and
I was expecting a different answer.
I understand that some of the staff work that's been done for the legislature indicates that we think the risk of deregulation is the reason why we should settle. We read the risk of deregulation as the reason why we should not settle, and we decided that that's the risk we're taking. We don't cite deregulation as we should run scared. The whole analysis is we should not run scared on that point. We don't see it as a high likelihood. And I believe that there is just a misperception as to how we solve the deregulation issue.
Another question. Thank you very, very much. I'd like to comment on David Billings. And
Madam Chairman, my name is Jacob P. Zillig. I'm an attorney from Washington, D.C. I've had the privilege of representing the North Pole Refinery since the inception of its operations in August of 1977. I've also, I might add, had the privilege of representing the Alaska legislature and the privilege to be the assistant to it, and I hope that the comments which I will offer today on behalf of the North Pole Refinery may also be of some assistance to it. With me today are Mr. Russell Park, who is the Assistant General Counsel of the parent company of the North Pole Refinery, immediately to my left in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and also to his left, Mr. Stephen T. Lewis, who is the Manager of Finance and Administration of the North Pole Refinery, who resides at North Pole. Madam Chairman, we appear here today on behalf of the North Pole Refinery, which operates the only refinery in the interior of Alaska, Fairbanks. As many of you are aware, this refinery has been in operation since August of 1977. And since that time, it has been furnishing refined products, including jet fuel, home heating oil, and turbine fuel to the citizens of the interior of Alaska. In addition, the refinery serves the Bush area and recently has begun selling jet fuel as well in the Anchorage market, thus reducing the dependency of that market on West Coast suppliers. Now, the ability of any interior refinery, whether it be the North Pole Refinery or any other, to compete in these markets which I've enumerated is substantially depended upon two interrelated factors. The first is the wellhead price of the oil, and the second is the tariff charge which is made for transportation. We are appearing here today because both of these factors are affected by the proposed settlement of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline case pending in Washington before the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Before addressing the merits of the proposed settlement agreement, I think it's important to point out that the North Pole refinery transportation costs, and in turn the cost to consumers in the interior of Alaska, are directly impacted by a variety of tariff rates and charges assessed by the tax carriers. Thus, in addition to the tariff charge for the transportation of oil from Pump Station 1 to Valdez, which has been discussed here today, which the, by the way, the refinery pays with respect to some 30,000 barrels per day, the refinery also pays a transportation rate with regard to moving of oil from Pump Station 1 to the North Pole Refinery 7. In addition, the carriers have assessed a so-called quality bank charge on the North Pole return oil movement. This charge is currently at a rate of 15 cents per degree API, approximately $2.10 per barrel of product. Under the methodology under which that charge is set, and which the carriers have proposed, this quality bank charge could exceed $5 a barrel of product. Since 1977, the North Pole Refinery has been seeking a variety of litigation to secure a reasonable rate and charges for its movement from the tax carriers. And to a certain degree, it has been successful before the Alaska Pipeline Commission, which is the predecessor of the Alaska Public Utilities Commission, which now has jurisdiction over these intrastate matters, in securing a mileage base rate for the movement to the refinery at Fairbanks. However, that rate is presently being challenged by the carriers in court. And with regard to the rates of Valdez, you have heard there has been an initial decision by the FERC Administrative Law Judge King. The quality bank case is pending the separate docket before the same judge. And in neither case, the Valdez rate case or the quality bank case, has there been any final resolution by the FERC. The settlement agreement proposes to deal with only one aspect of North Pole transportation charges, the rate to be assessed for the Valdez movement. It does not seek to settle the controversies which I've mentioned still outstanding for tax carriers with respect to the intermediate point rate to North Pole or the quality bank charge. And this fact that the proposed settlement addresses only a small part of the problem is a major difficulty which the North Pole Refinery has with that settlement. Now, insofar as the interior's interests are concerned, the thing is unclear from the proposed settlement to the extent that it does address the issues of the rates of LDs, that the effect of that settlement upon the refinery and, most importantly, its customers will be very adverse. To understand this, appreciate that the rate to Fairbanks is constructed as a percentage of the rate to Valdez. An increase in the interstate Valdez rate would mean, if it were adopted for intrastate purposes, which we think would be very likely, an increase in the intrastate Fairbanks rate. But on the other hand, it is also true a decrease in the Valdez rate would result not in an increase in the Fairbanks rank per se, but equally bad, an increase in the wellhead price. And that also would result in an increase in the cost of goods sold at Fairbanks. And under the settlement which is proposed, the cost per barrel, or the increase per barrel of that settlement, would be $1.37. This is a cost, unless there was a countervailing reduction in the Fairbanks rate, which would have to be borne by the consumers of Imperial Alaska as well as in the bush, It would also seriously disable efforts to supply needed fuel to the Anchorage market, to which I referred, which incidentally are shipped via the Alaska Railroad. In fact, the refinery is one of the significant shippers of that railroad. I trust that this indicates the complexity of the relationship of all of these factors which must be taken into consideration. Now, finally, the refinery has difficulty with the proposed settlement because it fails to accord any refunds of tariff charges which have been paid by the North Pole refinery since the early part of 1978. As a public company with a duty to its stockholders as well as to its customers to maintain a viable refinery operation, it cannot overlook these refunds. So, in summation, the interests of the energy consumer in Alaska, and of course the refiners, as I've described, were initially not fully understood and taken into account in reaching the proposed settlement, and created these difficulties with the settlement insofar as the refinery, insofar as we perceive the interests of the Alaska energy consumers concerned. However, we were very pleased and very gratified to hear today from the Attorney General his recommendation and his advice to you and his pledge to you that these matters which I have outlined of concern to the interior Alaska energy consumer and other Alaska consumers will be rectified and resolved before there would be any acceptance of the settlement agreement. Now, assuming that the rate quality bank issue specifically, which concern which Attorney General Condon recognized, are resolved in a matter which does meet the Alaska energy needs, the North Pole refinery would fully support the proposed settlement. That concludes my report. Billing, the rate you pay for oil is based on the wellhead value.
The transportation rate or
the actual purchase price?
Yes.
It's based on the wellhead value. If the state makes a settlement which reduces the transportation cost, that increases the wellhead value of the state's oil mix. And that represents the $1.37 extra you have to pay because our oil is worth more because the transportation and competitive market would be cheaper.
That's correct.
I agree with the concern in the transportation charge and the quality bank charge. The last time we went through that, it got so confusing in the second day to figure out what it was doing. But I think it's a tough issue for us to look at a settlement that provides several hundred million dollars more to the state and does mean that the state of Alaska's oil is worth more, and then try and use that as a pass-through in some way to North Pole refinery.
No, we agree with you completely, and let there be any misunderstanding, we are not advocating or asking that the settlement be disapproved because it results in a lower transportation rate and consequently a higher wellhead rate. The purpose of my testimony is to outline the complexity and the interrelationships of all of these factors. And what we would hope to see come out of this is, in fact, a lower rate to Valdez, in spite of the fact that it would mean a higher wellhead rate. But we would also hope to see come out of this is an adjustment in the intrastate rate being paid for the movement to North Pole, which could and would make a toll and would make the consumer whole with regard to that cost. We would also note that we feel there's very ample justification for that, particularly in view of the changed circumstances which have occurred since the intrastate grade was first described by the Alaska Pipeline Commission in June of 1978, and namely the acknowledgement by the tax carriers that the pinch point, the so-called bottleneck, has now moved by virtue of the use of the, what they call the drag-reducing agent, to a point south of the refinery. Now, this means that every barrel of oil
which is delivered to the North Pole refinery. And every dollar of revenue derived for those barrels is literally gravy revenue to the carriers, because those barrels could not in any event have been delivered to Valdez. And as a result of these circumstances, we are gratified that Attorney General Condon has taken the position he has, so that it now permits us to sit down with the task carriers and assess this rather complex, interrelated factual situation which we have, economic situation, and hopefully work out a solution which will result not in any penalties to the state of Alaska, not in any penalties to the refinery, and not in any penalties to the interior consumer.
My problem is I just want to make clear that I think it's certainly in the state's interest for the state to help you in the case dealing with the Quality Bank and transportation, but just, I don't think it's the obligation of the state to try and match an increase in cost based on increase in value of Alaska oil.
I trust you understand that we're not asking you to
clarify that.
Let me get the cut.
Thank you. I think you have better ears than I do. When we were discussing with the Attorney General what the quote loose ends were, he described three different loose ends that had not been settled yet. And I assume that's what you heard too.
Yeah.
One of them was the Quality Bank adjustment, the other was the rates to Fairbanks or DVA. The third was the non-opposition of the Justice Department. Well, those things haven't been settled, so there really isn't a settlement that's before us that we can see. So I guess the Attorney General left, no? Well, if those things aren't settled, the legislature hasn't seen and isn't able to give a recommendation, either pro or con, as to whether or not that this thing ought to be settled. I'm not even sure that I heard the Attorney General say that he would not settle this case without those three things being taken care of. He did describe those as loose ends, but I wasn't sure. I heard him say that it was an insurance. It was? That's the way you heard it. Would not settle unless those three things were taken care of.
Yeah.
Okay. So in that case, that's fine, but we don't know that's going to happen. We don't know how it's going to happen. So I suggest the legislature doesn't have an opportunity to review the final settlement until that's taken care of. Now, maybe bother Mr.
Well, may I just comment on that? I don't think that contemplated, and we've had discussions with the Attorney General, that, well, from my point of view, that whatever resolution is reached to these issues, that it's necessary to bring those before the legislature. I think that the feeling is that if a resolution could be reached to satisfactory, that then the agreement would go forward.
Satisfactory to whom?
Well, to the Attorney General, to the refinery, because our interest would be that of the Imperial Act in securing a lower transportation rate for the movement as I described. We are hopeful and very optimistic that it will be possible to have the resolution of these issues, and that it would not present a significant impediment either time-wise or substance-wise to the going forward of the settlement.
Lower
rate,
you mean a percentage
position
as a division?
So we'd like an adjustment in that.
Have you
given
the Senate
Department? There was something said about the lower tariff rate and impact this making you whole. Does that imply that you have reduced tariff if you compensate for the $1.37 per barrel or lower cost?
I would say right now that I think the governor's offered the legislature a token opportunity to participate in the settlement, to understand the settlement. We don't have a settlement in front of us. I think that it's all very nice for us to sit around and talk about this, but I don't really think that the legislature's involvement can be significant with the amount of time we're being given. And I'm interested in pursuing it further. Wish we had more time, we could have got started earlier. But to suggest that by the legislature doing nothing, that means we're putting our stamp of approval on this, I don't think that's a correct assessment by any stretch of the imagination. And I don't fault. I suppose I can't fault the legislature or anybody on the committee because we haven't had that opportunity. But for the governor to say that the legislature has had an opportunity to participate in this, I think it's not a very accurate statement. That's all I have.
I have other questions, Thomas. Do you have anything more to do with it? Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Impact on the only lap and using lap to good. All other users, but
not within the lower 48 degrees, which you absolutely know from Christ being for the sun. I think that that is in control of somewhere, and it would not be penalized by that. Just my point is that the effect of the proposed compromise settlement is not a deal that affects only the two negotiators, for the state of Alaska gets some future oil revenues immediately in return for dropping the potential retroactive claim. I suggest a mechanism be devised and incorporated into that assures the Alaskan users of this resource that their cost of crude will not change and thereby be given the same consideration to the other end users in Lower 48. I want to touch the quality bank. That's a costly item, or an item that we have to book many, many hundreds of thousands of dollars on, not knowing how it's going to fall. And I would urge that that ultimately be worked into the settlement as described earlier.
And they were kind of looking at a watch. They would pay more at the wellhead price, but they would save enough in transportation. So they're net roughly they were watch there, it would feel like the same price. Why would Golden Valley be paying 63 cents more a barrel? Because the fuel right from North Pole is right next door to them. They do have a watch on lower tariff. Wipes out the higher wellhead price, why would you pay more?
I understand the only work they have is to readjust the contract on the same thing. I'm assuming that the APUC will, when they act, would allocate the same percentage, 54 or 55% of the total tariff would be the tariff to North Pole to pump up. So with that scenario, we would be losing 63% of the tariff. Because the wellhead price was a full amount, we only see a 55% reduction in our tariff, $55 $37.
The problem is that it's not in the interest of those that use only half the line, and with their price based on wellhead value, to have